Hey, welcome everybody to another episode of Two Guys and a PLC podcast. I'm one of your hosts, John Marchando, and I'm joined by my brother from another mother.
Thank you, sir. Dave Gutshall here. And just a reminder for those of you that haven't listened to some of these before, this is for entertainment purposes only. Everything that you hear has absolutely nothing to do with our day job employer, Cisco Systems. And we highly encourage everything that you hear here, you double check. Check with your friends, your brothers, your mothers, everybody in between before you follow any of our advice, if we give any advice, that is. So we are joined today by one of our esteemed colleagues in our Talos organization inside of Cisco. I'll tell you, John, I've worked with Joe off and on for, going back a whole bunch of years. And I'm telling you, the experience that this guy has on the ground is just absolutely incredible. And I could probably like turn him on to a topic and he would just talk for hours and you wouldn't get tired of listening to him, because he's, not only is it that deep well of experience, but he's just a really great guy and he's great to like listen to the stories that the man has. So, man, I can't wait to
Very
talk
cool.
today.
Very cool. And the other thing I want him to touch on is a couple things. Number one, you guys have a beer history, so I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. And
you
I also understand there's some kind of a tie with Joe and Waffle House. So I want to know more about that, because there seems to be something there. I'm not sure what. I did a little research and saw something on that. So I guess with that, we'll kind of kick it off and turn it over and start talking through the podcast. So Joe,
Sounds
welcome.
Good. Thanks for having me. Mr. Gutshall, your flattery, sending me to the moon, man. I'm just swooning over here. Oh, geez.
The checks in the mail. No, I'm kidding.
That's great, man. I love it. I love it. Thank you very much for the super kind introduction. And, actually, as a cheeky little thing I was thinking about doing is, like, just on my resume, put Waffle House enthusiast somewhere on there. If you're from the Deep South, you understand. Like, if you know, you know.
I grew up in Houston, but I Waffle Houses are not really that prevalent in Houston, so.
Blows my mind, because that's very much the South.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I go to Georgia or something. Oops, sorry, Dave.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say sorry about that. There's a thing with them, too, about how they generally don't close. In fact, I think entities actually use them and the ones that are closed to kind of determine where aid and things need to go. I think that's a thing.
Yeah, the Waffle House Index, or the Windex, if you will.
There you go.
So years and years and years ago, some very smart people at FEMA basically used the availability of Waffle Houses after a natural disaster to determine how bad something is. Waffle House has this amazing resiliency team built into their corporation where, if a hurricane or an earthquake or God forbid, usually it's the South, so it's a hurricane usually.
Yeah.
Hits, like they have a red, yellow, green system in place where green is full menu, yellow is limited menu, and red is very limited, but we're still open. And they primarily work to feed first responders, but basically anybody that needs to get a hot meal. And it's Waffle House, so it's going to be cheap, and the quality of the food is debatable. If you're from the South, you love it. If you're probably not from the South, you don't see what the big deal is. But it is both a manna for the soul sort of restaurant, or Southern Hibachi is kind of what it's been referred to as. And, just a place, I grew up in a very small town in Alabama, and like the Waffle House was just where you went at 2 a.m, slightly drunk or slightly hungover. And that's just where you would meet all your friends there. They'd be there from some other thing. Hey man, how you doing? How's your mama doing? I ain't seen your brother in a while, etc. It's just kind of become one of those things. And then, and that's in small town Alabama, small towns all over the South. But if you're like, I don't know, in Atlanta or, it's a whole different vibe, but, you're just grateful that there's something you can get to eat that's going to be good in the morning. And it's a cultural thing, but yeah, I can remember some of my earliest memories was like going with my mom or some of my mom's friends that she worked with just to the Waffle House because we were dirt poor and the food there was cheap and it just kind of grows on you.
Yeah, and the FEMA thing.
Denny's.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Sorry.
The FEMA thing just leads me to believe that most natural disasters happen in the South.
You're not wrong.
Apparently.
You're not wrong, man. Hurricane Alley, they call it Hurricane Alley for a reason, man. It's precariously placed near oceans, and for better or for worse, I guess, suppose that's just kind of how it is. Although, like, I live in Maryland, and we've got like three or four in Maryland, but they're in the far boonies of Maryland. And I ain't driving all that way to go to one. So every time I go home to visit family, like within a day or two, I'm going to be at a Waffle House.
Love it.
Special with my coffee and water, and have no regrets.
That's much awesome.
Much to the chagrin of my nutrition coach and my diet.
Mm-hmm. But
look, you got to be an adult and just like, I eat what I want sometimes, you know?
And that's the truth.
I know.
Yeah. I was going to say, my house that had a tree fall on it last year could argue about the whole most natural disasters happen in the South. I'm just saying. But good stuff, Joe. So I guess maybe we talk about the beer thing for a little bit. There's not really too much there, except Joe's close enough to me that I can actually drive. We could like meet halfway. And so a number
That's
of
cool.
different times we've met at a brewery. Gosh, what's the name of it? BC, is it, Joe?
Yeah. It's really, really good. Like, I support any brewery that has a RFID, like you scan a card and it just opens up the tap and you pour your own beer. Like, it's self-serve beer and they just bill you on it that you pour. And one day I'm going to...
There's a revenue model there. Wait a minute. We should picket that a little bit.
Yeah, no, there is. One day I'm going to walk with my Flipper Zero and like just see how much beer I can get. No kidding. I'm not going to do that. I wouldn't be that mean. But like, it is 100% super kick-ass way to have a beer. And Dave and I availed ourselves of that system, and we tried all kinds of cool stuff. And actually, we got to go back there, Dave, because that place was awesome.
We absolutely need to do that. There's one other place, actually really close to me, that uses the same system, a place called Aviator Brew Hub. And they're the only other ones that I've seen use it.
Cool. That's cool.
Yeah, good stuff. Joe, you know, I'd love for you to regale us a little bit of your background, kind of how you ended up in the role you're in now, and then maybe I'll seed it with kind of one question, and that's, I'd love to hear maybe just a couple minutes of obviously what you can say about sort of the, you know, I'll call it especially the opening weeks and months of the, the war in the Ukraine.
Yeah, it's, that's a tough topic.
It is a tough topic.
It's like so this is something that's really weird about where my career has gone in cybersecurity, which is, you know, when you kind of start off in this career space, you sort of focus on the technical forensic details of, you know, malware or exfiltration of data or, you know, tactics, techniques, procedures, just various obfuscations and, you know, how the sort of kinetic dirt gets done inside of a breach and like what the outcomes are. And, you know, at a hyper nerd level, I love focusing on that stuff. But at some point in time in my life, and I don't know when, maybe it's just because I'm a forever student and I love to learn, is I kind of came up from air and I really started to, I examined not so much technical micro, but I'm really going into the macro now, I guess, in my career. And one of the things I've learned about Ukraine is, and I'm a huge history student because I believe the best stories are the ones that are real, is that Ukraine has been on the short end of a lot of sticks historically. Like, if you were to go back to, like, you know, the 1980s with the Holodomor, which was this massive starvation thing that Joseph Stalin did that killed millions of Ukrainians, and then you had World War II, of course, and then you had the Soviet occupation of Ukraine, you know, and then you had this brief joyous moment of freedom, and then you had the 2014 Revolution of Dignity, and then you have, you know, when Russia invades Crimea, and then you had the reinvasion in 2022. I mean, it is a heartbreaking series of historical events just to look at, and that's probably one of the reasons, like, every Ukrainian I've ever met are some hard dudes. Like, they are about that life. They are gangster because, like, you know, I remember when last time I was in Ukraine, I was talking with Vladimir, who's one of our Cisco guys out there. And he said, I was kind of talking about the vibe of Ukraine, you know, because, like, I've only been there twice, and that was my second trip, and I was just like, man, it's different here. And he goes, look, man, he goes, when I grew up as a kid in Ukraine, we had a Soviet tank at the end of my street watching us. He goes, there's no tanks from, you know, Russia sitting at the end of my street, and, like, that's the life that I had as a kid. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty messed up.
That's eye-opening. Oof.
Yeah, and he was just like, this is just how we are. This is the way we've been made because of historical events have just always fallen on us like that. So when Ukraine was reinvaded in 2022, you know, from a kinetic and from a cyber perspective, and from an electronic warfare perspective, which I focused a lot on in my career at Cisco, which is weird, but happened. Like, you cannot help but contextually take all of that and sort of assemble it together, and you just get this really wild picture of how the world works, how geopolitics works, and then how that macro fuels the micro, which is typically breaches and cyber attacks and extortions and ransomwares and all kinds of stuff. You know, like with the sanctions going on in Russia right now, like, you learn about the ransomware economy, and you learn about how the Russians are very happy to turn a blind eye to all the ransomware attacks that are sort of originate, or the nuclei of which, where the money flows back to the criminals, because that's money re-injected back into the Russian economy. So it and you're like, so why would they stop it? And of course they wouldn't stop it. They're making GDP off of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It is a domestic product that they're producing, and, mm-hmm. and, you know, and they make crazy amounts of money doing it. So,
and that's scary. That's just scary.
It's absolutely terrifying. And who's to say where sanctions are going to stay with the new president coming in? Like, we have no idea how this ball is going to fall. So the whole thing is just wild. Frankly, very depressing.
So what do you think the end game is there for the Ukrainians?
I wish I knew.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty difficult thing to answer. But
it is such a hard question. You know, so there's I think 560 of us in Talos. You know, we're on four different continents. You know, we speak 40 different languages. About 80 of them are Ukrainian. And the majority of them are still inside of Ukraine. Ukraine has an amazing IT, highly educated IT workforce in that country.
So true. Going back years, I used to remember software that I would use. And it was like, I don't know, some astronomical percentage was almost always a Ukrainian. I'll run across a random developer's page that might have a bunch of, again, some obscure page in the middle of nowhere that references something that helps me. And I mean, what? Probably 25 to 40% chance that it's Ukrainian. It's mind-boggling. Yeah.
Yeah, like they read the writing on the wall years and years ago and really developed that a very IT-strong and cybersecurity-strong workforce. So props to them.
Yeah.
So when you kind of examine in toto the history, the lay of the land, you know, kinetic cyber historical for Ukraine, it's like, yeah, it's incredibly depressing, but like you cannot help but admire just the absolute raw, unflinching tenacity of the Ukrainians. And I've got friends there now that work both for NGOs who are out there, you know, delivering aid to Ukrainians and even documenting war crimes. And then there's guys out there just trying to keep the power grid alive so that people can have power and enjoy civilization. That's why Talos and why myself are so heavily invested into the fates of the Ukrainian people, because these are people that we care about. We work with them, you know. I worry about them. I worry about their families. You know, I get super pissed off every time, you know, they send me pictures of drones buzzing their houses and blowing up other apartment complexes. And it's just, it devastates you. And actually, I was thinking about this today, and I don't mean to get like dark or serious or whatever, but there's some days I wish I cared less, because like this stuff weighs heavy on your shoulders, guys. Like,
no.
And if nothing, it just reminds me why I do what I do and why I work where I work, which is that in my own small ways, especially within cybersecurity, and frankly, in some big ways, if you guys are familiar with my power grid work, you know, it's about making a difference and making the world a better place, and frankly, just fighting the bad guys.
Yeah.
That's really what I'm all about.
And I was going to bring up that, you know, what you did with some of the phaser sensors on the, you know, in the power grid. So would love to talk more about, you know, your experience there and how you were able to make a difference and help them keep the power going.
Yeah, man. Super, super wild story. And when I look back at it, I'll forever look back at it, I guess. I'm still incredulous that we pulled the damn thing off. You know, so Ukrenergo is this state-owned transmission operator out in Ukraine, you know. So like in America, our power grid's massive, right?
This is Project Power Up, right?
Yes, it's Project Power Up.
Like, okay.
So American power grid is huge. And so we have to have multiple transmission operators that manage this massive, millions upon millions of miles of high voltage line. Ukraine's smaller, right? They really only have one organization that does it, and they're state-owned, and they're called Ukrenergo. So it's their jobs to work with the distribution power utilities out there and balance the larger transmission grid, you know? So you can't have distribution if you don't have transmission and you don't have generation. So they're the guys spinning the plates and trying to keep the plates from falling down all over the country. So their job is really hard, especially in a war zone. So like in 2023, it was you know, I was breaking bread with them out in San Jose. Actually, I flew all the way over there just to give them a cybersecurity brief. We'd been helping them since the reinvasion of Ukraine. And when the, just by dumb luck, the account manager put a ticket in and said, hey, can someone come talk to Ukrenergo? I'm like, heck yeah, I'll go. A, I'm a power, you know, grid expert, cybersecurity expert. And B, and we've been blood, sweat, tears looking at their grid, helping them do forensics and triage. And I'm like, so I made a custom presentation just for them to talk about the events that we occurred, that we witnessed occurring in their network. And that's all it really was. Like I was, while I was there, I couldn't help myself. Like, and we're having dinner, we're eating these amazing steaks. And I'm like, so what's going on? And they took me to school, man. They were telling me wild stories of just the insane things they were having to do for blown up transformers and missiles and drones. And I'm like, I didn't even finish my food. Like my steak got cold. I just stopped eating it because I was just asking so many questions and we were chatting and whatnot. And they made like a really offhanded comment. They're like, man, we can't even get GPS to work. And in my utility days, I used to work for utility. In the back of my mind, I was like, yeah, GPS is important. And I was like, well, why is it important? And I was like, no, it matters for like phasers and stuff. But like power grid engineering is so damn complex that my brain just knew it was important, but couldn't quite parse how important. And, the conversation would end and I would go back to Cisco. And I'm kind of truncating a lot of stuff here or summarizing because it's a long story. But when I got back to Talos and I talked with a lot of my peers in other industries or other, you know, they're like in manufacturing or power or water, but you know, we're all very familiar with ICS and ICS security equipment. And I was telling them about this GPS thing and I'm like, man, that sounds wild. I'm like, yeah, it is wild. And nobody had an answer, right? So I come back to Talos, I talk to my leadership. They get me connected with the ELT here at Cisco, which is an amazing thing. Shout out to Anthony Greco and some other guys for really helping me out. And they got me directed to some really, really, really smart people in our IoT business unit that are down in Texas that design these ruggedized switches that have these sort of clocks inside of them. So you're probably wondering, GPS, why the hell does it matter? We don't care about where you are. We care about when you are. So you have these satellites in orbit and we use them on our iPhones and our Androids to, you know, find out where we are and, you know, what traffic is like. But there's also atomic clocks inside of all those little satellites and they're hyper accurate, nanoseconds of accuracy. And there's like for the US constellation, there's like 32 in orbit. They're medium Earth orbit. And when you're managing a massive transmission power grid, you know, power is generated and consumed in real time. You know, it's moving at the speed of electron, at the speeds of physics, which is very fast. And as a practical method, there's just no way to store power on the grid. So let's say we can't take a coal plant offline, but we have a Tesla Powerwall the size of a skyscraper that's going to handle the grid for a little while. They don't make those. It's just not feasible. So What we basically did was we said, okay, they don't have GPS. And if you don't have GPS, you cannot synchronize your grid. You know, I use the metaphor and I bounce this off my mom who, if she can understand it, then I can explain it to anybody. But, you know, think of these electrons that I'm talking about as a giant marching band. And they're in the Ukrainian grid, their transmission grid alone, their high voltage line is 25,000 kilometers long. And I said, you know, you've got a marching band 25,000 kilometers long and the tubas can't hear the woodwinds and the trumpets can't even hear the drums. Because they're thousands of miles long, but they all need to march, you know, step on their left foot every 2 seconds. It's not going to happen. It's impossible. But you can measure it and make corrections, right? And to do that, you need a stopwatch that everybody's on, no matter where you are in that country, that is accurate to every other stopwatch. GPS solves that because we're all looking at the same satellites in orbit. Easy peasy, man. Cheap, easy, worldwide standard. We use it in the United States. We use it everywhere else. Well, because you're in a war zone, what happens when that's taken away from you, right? So electronic warfare does that. You know, we have to jam the missiles. We have to jam the drones. They're all GPS guided. So if I take that away from them, I'm taking it away from myself. It sucks. And it causes blackouts. Not immediately, but it happens. And so when I got connected with these IoT BU fellas who are forever my heroes, I explained the problem. And they went, we think we've got something that'll do it. And it turns out IE5000, you know, one of our older but really great robust switches. Has this, it's not an atomic clock, but it's a real high quality crystal oscillator inside of it that's like insulated and ruggedized because these things are meant to go in like really inhospitable places that electronics don't like. And they went, we think we can modify the firmware, the guts of this thing, and we think we can do this. And I went, okay. So they ended up basically rewriting portions of the firmware inside of these devices. And when I thought we were onto something, I called the Ukrainians up. I said, look, I don't want to get your hopes up. But I think we're on to something. And they were immediately over the moon because I didn't want to tell them, hey, we're working on this, and go, ah, shucks, it didn't work out. Like, I wanted to make sure I had something. And I would reach out to my government friends, you know, and by the end of the whole project, there was 40 of us on this thing. I got Cisco Critical Accounts team involved.
40, that's a lot.
Well, so it was, you know, the Department of Energy. We had Ukrainians, we had other vendors who controlled power equipment inside of that country that stepped in to help us when we had questions.
Okay. So this wasn't just within Cisco. This was just the whole community of, okay.
Yeah. This was a multinational, multi-company effort. It started with,
gotcha.
I'm a persuasive guy. So I got my friends.
You are that, sir.
And I got people to show up, and we even got the Air Force to kind of smuggle our switchers in, our prototypes, to make sure they would work. Yeah, I've got pictures to prove it, man. Like, we have a humanitarian aid shipment leaving, and the DOE guys were like, hey, if you can get these switches like in a few days, we can actually have them on this military flight to Poland. And I went, okay. And so it was just dumb luck that worked out. Then these switches got delivered to Poland, and eventually they made it into Ukraine, and it took some back and forth. It's a very opaque system for operating a transmission grid, and that's where some other vendors came in who made the system, who helped us. And eventually we figured it out. I think they just yanked the cable out of the thing. GPS went away, and our switches basically hacked the power grid and said, hey, we're the satellites now, don't panic. And it worked. And it kept all of them synchronized. And when the satellites are available, we just turn invisible. And it's, to this day, I'm shocked we made this system work. And that it just goes to show that there's so many smart people inside of our company. And honestly, there's just so many people around the world that have such big hearts and care and want to make a difference.
That's amazing, Joe. That story, it's interesting because I was actually volunteering this morning for Junior Achievement, and the activity that I got was problem solving. And so I spent 4 30-minute blocks talking to eighth graders about the importance of problem solving and how you do it, and just, you know, getting them to recognize in this today's complex world how you have to work together. And literally, I listened to that story, and that's like I wish I would have had this conversation prior to that volunteering effort this morning, because this would have been like the ultimate problem solving. You know, you get the right creative minds in a room, and you know that whole thing of you can accomplish anything. Literally, you can accomplish anything.
Yeah,
you need good leaders like yourself, Joe.
Yeah, thank you. My former boss mentor, Matt Wachinski, said something really poignant. He said, you know, if you got a really hard problem to solve, you don't need 100 people. You just need 5 to 10 really smart people with a really good, diverse skill set who really care about a problem, and they can fix almost anything.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah, and that's basically how this whole thing started. And when I needed to bring somebody in, I would reach out to like the critical accounts team, which, by the way, I did not realize they had so much power inside of Cisco. It turns out they only answered our CEO.
Wow.
The critical, like they're like, if something's wrong with a customer, they're the ones that move mountains to make it go away and make the customer.
So this is where the cap case happens, and they're involved in things like that. Okay.
They are the cap case.
All right.
Yeah, the cap case gets started, it's because of them. But they have, you know, a tremendous and responsibly used, but power inside of Cisco to make things right. And there is an open cap case for Ukraine. So I just kind of piggybacked on that. Again, I got lucky. But once I explained to them that we're gonna go save lives in Ukraine with this, they were all aboard. Like, it was never hemming and hawing. No, it was. Now, we argued about like what equipment we should use and timelines and blah blah blah. But that's normal. And at the end of the day, you know, we made it work. And again, it was such a massive, massive team effort. I don't want to call like my career magnum opus, because I'm only 45 and gosh knows what else I'm going to do in my life. But like, this is kind of one of those things that I can look back and go, no matter where I go in my career and what I do, I made a difference.
And you can look at this and say, no matter what happens, you can look at this and say, I was able to turn this around and make it work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it taught me so much about myself, about leadership, about, you know, moving fast and, you know, perfect is the enemy of good enough, and how to win friends and influence people. Cause I had to build a coalition of the willing or semi-willing, and also about having for me anyways, a great leadership structure above me that supported me. Because I, you know, somebody made something really, I didn't talk to this person very often, but they made a very poignant comment to me just out of the blue, which was, you know, going and helping to save the Ukrainian power grid wasn't on your OKRs. You know, it wasn't a key performance.
Right.
I see you.
Right.
You just did it.
Just did it.
Because that's
it was the right thing to do. right?
It was the right thing
because
to do.
And you were needed. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I read about it online, I knew we had to talk about it. So I'm glad Dave asked the question because that is a really, really cool story.
Yeah. And you know, as cool as it is to talk about it, I wish I didn't have to. I wish this thing was
great point.
Yeah, and my friends are safe and living a happy life, but that doesn't appear to be in the cards.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Joe, for history lesson of how you helped, but how we helped. And then ultimately, look, everybody out there, this is a crazy, complex world. I just ask everybody, right? You know, what do they say, right? Look for the helpers. Help your friends. Help your colleagues. Talk to them about what they need. You know, be the good person in the room. We need
ask people how they are and mean
people.
It, right?
That's
ask
right.
people how they are and mean it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had an observation that I got an award for my work in Ukraine, and it's this really cool PCB that's blue and yellow, cut out of Ukrainian country from the ICS security community that I'm a part of, and it was bowled me over because I had no idea that I was going to get this award, and they were like, "Hey, man, you've really earned this." But when I had to give an acceptance speech that I was not prepared to give, and so I just kind of spoke from the heart, I guess. And one of the things that I thought of sort of on the spot was, and this is in life in general, right? You know, if you're sitting with somebody and they're having a hard time, and whether it's personal or professional, they're struggling, just be present, right? Like, you don't have to have all the answers, you know? I didn't have any answers when I was talking to the Ukrainians that one night, you know? I had no idea. And turns out, you know, there's that funny meme, you know, we do these things not because they're easy, but because we thought they would be easy. You know, I thought it would be easy.
Yeah.
Like, we'll figure out something with this GPS. We'll go buy some atomic clocks, or we'll do some hand wavy stuff. And it turns out that absolutely could not happen. But being present and just listening is everything. Doesn't mean you are obligated to find the answers, but that you showed empathy and you were there for them. And then maybe, just maybe, you might find the answers down the road, and it can make all the difference in the world. But you were there, like you weren't on your phone or like, you know, just brushing off, like, no, someone was in a crisis and you just stop and go, what can I do?
Well put, Joe. You only need to, you know, make a difference every day, but make a difference to the people that you know, the people that you touch. It doesn't matter whether you're making a difference to 100,000 people or that one person. And sometimes, to your point, right, the difference that you're making just by sitting there and listening, you may not even realize the difference that you made. You find out later that, you know, thanks, Joe, for being there and listening to me. I really needed to talk that out. Yeah, 100%. Maybe we pivot to some other cybersecurity stuff because, man, we're getting heavy in this call. Good things. Absolutely,
so, go ahead.
It is.
It is.
Absolutely, it is. So something that I said, I think, on one of the previous podcasts, and I'm kind of curious to get your take, is, look, you can argue all you want about the where we are on the Gartner hype cycle curve with AI and what have you. But one thing that scares the crap out of me is some of the research that's come out and said, look, the bad guys are turning models against the vulnerability disclosures. And they're essentially reading the vulnerability disclosure and turning around and immediately making an exploit kit. So the vulnerability disclosures have become, in a way, de facto 0 days, because it generally takes the good guys a little bit of time to develop mitigation and fixes, let alone patches. So I'd love your take on, is that real? If it is, what the heck are all of us good guys doing about it?
So I don't have the full AI picture, to be honest with you, because frankly, it's moving faster than really any of us can follow. If we look at everything through the lenses of our own experiences, as a threat researcher and a security strategist and all the other hats that I wear, you know, I look at it more in terms of how would I, as a bad guy, use this to do evil, right? So I've gotten, you know, like a Gen AI, you know, ChatGPT to help me write, you know, JavaScript to help steal credit card data. I've gotten it to help me to write, you know, a basic keylogger, a very small keylogger. But the thing is at least for me, I know the questions to ask, and I know when I'm being fed a line of crap. Right, I have a foundational level of expertise to evaluate what's being presented as fact to me, and I can go, "Nah, they got this wrong," or "They're half right," or "I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure this is wrong. Let's look at it deeper." You know, a security muggle come in off the street's not going to be able to use
security that. Muggle. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, it's
that's
it's
great.
Well, like,
Harry Potter references.
Yeah,
right.
It's a phrase I use often. I don't know why, but I use it. I love it.
I love it.
So I think what you said though is actually pretty interesting to me, because I'm less worried about, every Tom, Dick, and Harry with, ChatGPT and a burning desire to go hack something, and more about the nation states that have just endless piles of money and compute and will, go solve these things any way they can by doing that. I think, was it yesterday or the day before, Google used their DeepThink Gen AI thing to create a zero day for SQLite. And I was blown away by that. And I went, wow, they actually found a real zero day with a probably ridiculously expensive and complex like AI thing. And they actually got a patch issued for it and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, maybe we've gotten to somewhere I never thought we would actually be. But I don't think we're there yet. And I think that we're also reciprocating on our side, because, something that we don't talk a lot about at Talos or other places is that we have our own offensive security research we're doing too. And we're doing it because we know they're doing it, right? So, much like football, offense drives defense and vice versa, right? If you're going to run four wideouts and no backfield and, double tight end or whatever, then I'm going to run a dime package and I'm going to have three down linemen, a linebacker, and as many DBs and safeties as I can cram on the field, right? So, you have to reciprocate and modify yourself to be able to defend. And the analogy plays over to this as well, because, we do the exact same thing. It's something that we don't really talk about often here, but at Talos, man, we've been using AI for years. We have to. We ingest 6 petabytes of threat telemetry a day. Do you think we have enough eyeballs for 6 petabytes of data? So we have to automate and analyze an AI a ton of that data for trend analysis, for victimology. And then us, we nerds in Talos basically pan for gold. I'm looking for that 0.01% of, oh, that's neat or cute or novel or, some spike in activity that happened that I can maybe do deeper analysis on to see what the bad guys are up to. But yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of going on a ramble here, but you kind of go where I'm going with it.
Yeah, thank you, sir. One thing's for sure is heck, and that is when I've listened to comparisons from the FBI has made comments at some of their public talks before about the size of what I'm going to call it, the team inside the U.S. When you add up essentially all of the three-letter agency cybersecurity teams and you compare them to the foreign actors that we're worried about, our team is dwarfed. It's ridiculously dwarfed. Orders of magnitude smaller. And so regardless of what I might think or believe on the AI front and where we are, we need something to be able to augment those teams, because the humans aren't going to be enough.
It's just going to get worse. It's just going to get worse.
Just going to get worse, John. Yep.
Yeah. So there's it can actually be such a tremendous force multiplier for defenders. If you want to write a Splunk query or Elastic or whatever you're using, you can go to a ChatGPT and I need a Splunk query to do this. And if you have an acumen with Splunk, you can probably get at least an idea of, oh, I could write this to go detect for bad guys like RDP exploitation, or a scheduled task has been modified with a malicious executable or something. So the sword definitely cuts both ways. But any tool, you need to have experience using it and then have an acumen behind it to make it effective. So it's not magic, thankfully. It's not magic. And as defenders, we're just going to keep our eyes on it.
Wow. Yeah, spot on.
So another subject that comes up a lot, just because Dave and I do manufacturing, is the threat environment on the plant floor is kind of the wild, wild west today. And, we have a lot of companies that do a lot of different things, and IT doesn't always talk to OT, and they do separate strategies for protecting the OT environment. IT goes in one direction, OT goes in another. What's your perspective on how that's going to, I don't know if the word is settle out over the next, several years, but, where do you think that security in that area is going?
Well, that is a really complicated question. Thank you for asking it, because I didn't want to answer it. So it depends on where you go, right? So if you have a manufacturer that's in a very mature, or, mostly mature, or they're making, you kind of know it when you see it, right? They've got a really good cybersecurity policy. They've got a modest amount of integration in IT and OT. And yeah, there's friction. There's always going to be friction, but they can get through it, right? Typically that maturity level existed because there was risk analysis done, and they went, crap, we would lose a ton of money if something like this actually happened. And everyone was like, yeah, that's not good. We should invest some dollars to make sure that, you know, that doesn't happen to us. But there's a lot of smaller mid-market, small market manufacturers that frankly just don't know until they know. And maybe they planned for it, maybe they didn't. Even if they did plan for it, like Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Until they get punched in the mouth. That's right.
Yeah.
Love, so, that like, quote. So, like, love that quote. It's so freaking true.
What was it Sun Tzu said? No plan survives contact the enemy. I think Mike Tyson's is much more elegant.
That's right. Yeah. He's a lot smarter than we give him credit for.
Iron Mike is a lot smarter, a lot wiser than we thought. So so from a manufacturing perspective, I can tell you this, like threat wise, they're consistently in the top five most victimized people or organizations that we track. And that's primarily because the bad guys definitely know that that manufacturing can be really expensive, and that if there's fragility there, then I can get paid. So let's say, you know, I tell the story a lot. You know, I was talking with a major vehicle manufacturer, and like we were smoking and joking the whole meeting, man. You know, they were ripping on me, and I was, you know, once the vibe was what it was, I was ripping on them back. Dave, you may have been in this meeting, I don't know. And this was a few years ago. I don't get to talk to many vehicle manufacturers. Like I talked to a lot of manufacturing, but just vehicle manufacturing is just, you know, for like the big three in the United States, it's not often you get to talk to any one of them, much less any of the smaller manufacturers.
We need to fix that, Joe. Just saying.
Yeah, no.
I agree.
I'm here for it, man. So like, I'm like, hey, the meeting was over, by the way. And I'm like, hey, man, let me ask you guys a quick question because I don't get to talk to you guys often. What happens if one of your assembly lines just for one day goes down for like your most popular selling truck or car? And it was like I had just farted in the room. Like I sucked the oxygen right out of that room, man. It was not good. And I pretty much erased every smile like instantly. Because I could tell I didn't realize I'd stepped on a landmine, but I very much had just, you know, poked at something that maybe wasn't sensitive, but they had clearly done the math and figured out it would be bad. And one guy goes, yeah, we're going to have a real, real bad day if that happens. Sort of the epilogue to that is this year I was at a really amazing conference called S4. And I happened to be sitting down with some more vehicle manufacturers and we were eating lunch, you know, that's what I like to do, sit down to lunch at these conferences with people I don't know and go, hey, man, what do you see? What do you know? I'm Joe from Cisco. And I asked them the same question and these guys were much more open about it. They're like, yeah, we would lose like a second, like tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that could be a very expensive number for just 1 hour of outage. And he goes, yeah, it gets really expensive. So like that's a major manufacturer that's done the math, right? But like if I'm Bob's toilet seat manufacturer in Oshkosh, you know, or, you know, Grand Rapids, Michigan, or wherever you happen to be, like, and you're less than 1,000 employees, you get smacked with ransomware, like, and you may or may not have a cyber insurance policy to cover your outage. Like, man, you're going to get smoked so hard and it's going to be bad. And the bad guys know that because they are about getting paid.
Yeah.
That's why medical is so lucrative to ransomware, because they know human lives can and have been lost because of these attacks. That's why they target, you know, educational institutions, because academia struggles for cybersecurity dollars. Yeah, they're not stupid. They want to make money. So that's why manufacturing is always going to be on the chopping block for targeting by these financially based actors.
Yeah. So
because these are like big, sorry, Dave, I just had another question that I wanted to kind of toss in. So I guess a lot of the manufacturers feel like they're safe because they're totally air gapped. And you know, I know air gapped means it's not, right? When you say that term, but you know, that it's a, like a big city that's totally walled off and it's not in a big manufacturing facility and there's no connection to the outside world in a lot of cases. What do you say to people that have that argument? You know, we're really not that as exposed as we think we are.
Do you remember that commercial, maybe it still exists, where like, I want to go buy a used car, but I don't know the history of the car. And they're like, show me the Carfax or the Carfox or whatever the heck it was called. Prove to me this vehicle hasn't been flooded or in an accident and repaired and you're selling me a lemon or whatever. I kind of think of that phrase every time someone says that, which goes like, and I say to myself, show me the pen test report. Like, prove to me right now with facts that you have paid a professional organization to come in here and prove that this thing is completely air gapped. Because friends, I have traveled the world and I have never found an air gap network, despite whatever anyone has ever told me.
Like I said, when you say it's air gap, that means it's not.
Exactly.
It's
not.
And I'm not going to walk it back down, but I want to contextualize what I just said, because I'm not going to be like, Joe Marshall from Cisco Talos said I'm foolish, pardon my French.
Remember the disclaimer, Joe. Remember the disclaimer. Sorry. You're good, man. Say what you need.
Yeah. No, fair point. Thank you. That's a great disclaimer now that I think about it. What I'm saying is that there are compelling and strong business imperatives that require organizations to not be air-gapped. And that's okay. That is perfectly fine because you have to move at the speed of business. And like if you've got, even if it's just a data diode, if it's a one-way flow of information to a cloud vendor you use for data analytics or whatever, we did that a lot in the power utility space, like for smart meters and whatnot. So manufacturing, I'm sure, has their own unique industry needs as well. That's okay. That's perfectly fine. It can even be two-way. It doesn't matter because you still got to patch that network. Like you figure out like what you need to do because you've got business imperatives behind there. Where you're going to step on landmines is if you haven't stopped to go, well, oh crap, if we do this, what risks do we have? You ask the hard questions. And there's plenty of places that haven't done it, or they've asked them incomplete, or they just don't have the institutional knowledge necessary to defend themselves and ask those questions because you don't know what you don't know. And so that's why I always think, man, air gaps. And everyone's like, oh, TOT convergence is dirty. And no, I'm like, no, it's perfectly fine. Like, we live in a world where that's almost mandatory, well and truly. And I bet to stay competitive, a lot of businesses did it years ago and, you know, just don't want to call, they don't want to call their children ugly because they know that they're their children. So, like, it's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And I never, like, castigate or finger wag at people that, like, talk about air gapping. And I'm like, just show me the pen test because otherwise I'm never going to believe you. A true story, I was in Ukraine at a major electric utility. They were basically saying like, yeah, our OT system's air gap. So I'm in one of their data centers and I pull out my phone and I'm like, I'm just curious as to what's going around me from a Wi-Fi perspective. And I literally see
with no security on it, open probably.
You know, I think maybe it was security or not. Maybe
username, user, password, yeah, and you're
something.
In.
Yeah. And so I call over our intel guy, Azim, who speaks, he's from Turkmenistan, his family is, he speaks fluent Russian. And I go, Azim, look at this. And he laughs and chuckles and I chuckle and I go, ask him where this is hooked up to. I'm not doing a pen test or a site assessment, right. We're actually doing other stuff, but I'm like, I gotta ask. And so he goes over and shows them the AP on his phone and they basically go like, oh no, that's the car dealership across the street. That's not us. And I'm like, you guys are full of crap. So I'm like, come on, man. Like, you don't
what are they doing SCADA at the car dealership? Come on.
Yeah.
That's just to throw people off and make it think that it's you. No.
Exactly.
That's the Renault dealership across the street. Come on, man. But like, that's just an example of like, you know, and it's a funny story, but like, there's plenty of places that are kind of that naive or they're just not asking the right questions. Yeah.
That's great, Joe. Well, we're running down to the end here. And so I wanted to end with maybe a practical question that's still related to everything that we've talked about in a way. And that is, look, there's all kinds of threat actors out there. There'd be dragons around every single corner, and the dragons are changing their stripes and attacking in different ways on a regular basis. But, you know, we have the business side of things and we have the personal side of things. And for folks out there, Joe, what's your top three things that anybody, you referenced your mother before, that anybody, regardless of skill level, skill set, whatever, should be doing to protect themselves?
Nah, easy. MFA, all the things. MFA, everything. MFA, your email, MFA,
yeah.
Your bank account, MFA, every damn thing you have that you'd be like, wow, if I lost this, this would suck. And even if you don't think it, do it anyways. If they offer it, do it. Yeah. Also, don't use SMS MFA. If you can, use an application-based MFA. Microsoft has one that's free. Google Authenticator.
Google Authenticator, yeah.
Google Authenticator is great.
Oh, it's I don't free. Like their data privacy practices. I'll give you another one. I got to figure out who makes it. I'm going to look it up right now.
Look it up, my friend, because I'm always curious.
OTP off. OTP
okay, yeah,
off.
Them.
From
yeah,
Roland
yeah.
Mowers.
Yeah. Yes, just use a MFA solution.
Hey, I had somebody suck $40,000 out of my savings account about a year and a half ago. Dave heard me tell this story. I mean, I'm like, holy shit, how did that happen? It was like, oh, my friend Elvis Valentine. I don't know any Elvis Valentines, but that was where it went. The bank got it back to me same day, but I was like, oh, what am I going to do now?
Man.
Yeah.
What's your third one, Joe?
No, that's only my first one, pal. Second one is...
I can't count. You're right.
Yeah. So MFA, don't use SMS. SMS, you could do SIM swaps. There's easy ways to intercept I say easy. With the right knowledge, you can intercept text messaging and intercept 2FA SMSing in application MFA, much safer. Two, use a password manager. Do not store your passwords in your web browsers, because it is info stealers will take it in a microsecond, and it's not as protected as you think or wish it was. So use a password manager. Use a
say
vault.
Not now, people. LastPass. I know it's a couple more clicks. Say not now. Turn it off. Don't let the browser do it. I agree.
Yes, for the love of God, yes. Just use your password manager. They make in-browser ones that you also can MFA, and you should. So use a friggin' password manager, especially for enterprises, because that is one of the A-plus number one ways we see valid accounts stolen and compromised, which is through in-browser info stealers. And before the pop-up even happens, it's trying to get you to click the I just won the lottery thing. They've already stolen everything. It's that fast.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. And the third and the last thing is, for the love of God, keep your stuff updated. Auto, like when Chrome says there's an update, if Firefox says there's an update, if Windows says there's an update, do not wait. Do the thing. Do it immediately. Set it to automate so that you don't have to think about it. It just happens. And you will reduce, you won't eliminate, but you will reduce a lot of your threat profile just by doing those three things.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Great advice, man. Great advice. Yeah. We need to have you back on here again. There's so many things we can pick at. I haven't talked about Banjo yet, so we definitely want to talk through that. So there's lots of stuff. I did my homework.
That's fantastic, man. Hey, brother, I'm here for it. If you want to talk Waffle House and banjos, that's my target demographic. Let's go.
Love it. Yeah, we might have to rename that episode, but to something other than Two Guys in a PLC. But who knows?
Oh my God, that's great.
Good times. Well, Mr. Marshall, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hopefully you got something out of today. And we'll see you the next time on Two Guys in a PLC.
Hi, everybody.
Bye, friends.